You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bruce O'Goodness. This show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at The Final Straw Radio. Noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawvideo@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you're free to do so. Just send us an email so that we know that you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop. This week we're speaking with Tyler Durden, an anarchist based in Portland who's involved in PDX, ABC, or Portland Anarchist Black Cross, and the Portland chapter of the Industrial Workers of the World, or IWW, who's been involved in doing outside support work and organizing around the upcoming September 9th National Days of Prisoner Work Stoppage to End Prison Slavery. A few quick announcements for this episode. There's a call out for actions of solidarity with the folks resisting the Dakota Access Pipeline, as we spoke about a couple of episodes ago in Gil's interview with LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who owns the land where the Sacred Stone Camp is held. Resistance to the pipeline in North Dakota, designed to carry crude oil from source through three states to Illinois and cross the Missouri River a number of times, continues to grow. Indigenous peoples and their supporters are gathering for nonviolent direct action protests to block the pipeline's construction and the threat it poses to the soil, animals, plants, and the longest water source river in North America, the Missouri River. From nodaplsolidarity.org comes a call for hashtag NoDAPL Global Weeks of Solidarity Action from September 3rd through 17th. The site also offers suggestions of places to target, including maybe local branches of businesses or banks where one might visit and express their distaste with the pipeline project. Also, if you're in the U.S. and looking to plug into into supporting prisoner struggle in your area, check out itsgoingdown.org/spread-strike-solidarity-actions-across-north-america-september-9th/ for a partial list and a growing list of events nationwide. If you're planning a public event that's not listed up there, email it to info@itsgoingdown.org for others to see and join. Here in Asheville, folks plan to meet up at Aston Park at the corner of South French Broad and Hilliard in downtown on September 9th at 5:30 p.m. to discuss a solidarity march. It's suggested that folks bring their banners, noisemakers, signs, and so forth. Former political prisoner, prison activist, and anti-racist agitator Coyote Acabo is looking for support. He's been facing charges in relation to resisting neo-Nazis in Olympia, Washington during the anti-Blue Lives Matter protest last year surrounding the attacks on two African-American young men accused of stealing beer in Olympia, which we spoke of in a past episode, and other court dealings for just being generally a good guy. You can find out more information at rally.org/support, COYOTEACABO, for how you can send him a little bit of cash to make his life a little less hard right now. Also, there's a call out for international solidarity for the ZAD, the Zona de Fondre, in the Notre-Dame-de-Lande area of Brittany, France. The large-scale and long-lived land occupation and resistance struggle against the building of an airport that will never actually be built. Quote from their support call out: on October 8th, tens of thousands of people will gather at the ZAD to demonstrate that the determination of the movement is as strong as ever. Honoring farmers' struggles from the past, we will come together with wooden walking batons and leave them on the zone as a sign of the commitment to come back and pick them up again if necessary. We'll also raise a barn built by dozens of carpenters during the summer, which will be used as a base should eviction happen. We're calling on all international groups and movements to either come to the zone on October 8th or show their solidarity with the ZAD through actions directed at the French government or multinational Vancy in their own towns and cities on that day. And Vancy, as has been discussed before, is involved in all sorts of infrastructure projects, including in the U.S., working on highway expansion in Georgia, and running the administration of parking meters in New York State, and just all sorts of stuff. They're all over the place, and they're very proud of it. So you can visit Vancy's website through a secure portal and just see what kind of stuff they're involved in and see how you can plug yourself in. It's V-I-N-C-I. More announcements can be found at zad.nadr.org. And now a few words from Anarchist Prisoner Franz Wayne.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
You know, I had every intention of using this segment in order to promote the national work stoppage that's to be undertaken by U.S. prisoners beginning September 9th. For all of you five people out there who read the claptrap that I write, you might recall that in 2007, I responded to a question in an Anthony Racine interview and said that if Ohio prisoners just laid on their bunks for 30 days, the entire state's economy would collapse and wouldn't recover for a decade. So you'd think a national call-out joined by the industrial workers of the world, a union to which I belong, would be right up my alley. Prisoners across the country driving the police state into bankruptcy and ruin. I sure wish I could endorse the national strike, but I can't. You see, not long ago, Sadiq Abdullah Hassan, a fellow Ohio prisoner, was tossed in the hole for his vocal support for the September 9 national strike. To make matters worse, it was the FBI who gave the order to segregate Sadiq. They called it in to Jay Lowdown, the warden at OSP. So, anyway, since the FBI and the entire national security apparatus is listening in, I'll have to refrain from saying anything to get me into trouble. I've had enough problems with the fascist bozos of ineptitude. I'm going to carefully go down this checklist of stuff I wanted to talk about and see if I can say any of these things. So first it occurred to me that I could discuss solidarity actions that you guys out there could undertake in support of the September 9 strike, but that's out. If I discuss those actions, you might do them, and then I'd get tossed in the hole for talking about them. And discussions of prison parking lots are definitely out. You know, because all prisons have parking lots attached where workers' cars are located. I'm not going to say anything about coffee cans full of nails dumped in the entrances or keying cars parked in the warden's spots. That's out. Sorry. Way too provocative with the FBI listening in, especially since the FBI has parking lots outside of their field offices where they park their cars. They wouldn't appreciate my advocacy of such actions. So we can scratch that. Or leaving junker cars blocking the entrances with tires slashed and the parking brake broken off and the doors locked so no one can get in or out at shift change. Scratch that too. Or talking about sneaking up on perimeter vehicles when they're parked and cramming potatoes in the tailpipes. That's out. The FBI would call train wreck Trevor, who would shove his hand up the ass of Warden Shea Harris, to use him as a sock puppet to toss me straight in the hole. So I'm not saying any of that. Sorry, not me. The cyber and communications attacks are out, too. I sent out lists of ODRC and Warren Correctional fax lists for posting, so folks out there can repeatedly send faxes of black construction paper and burn up the ODRC's toner and paper. Of course, if I talk about that, folks would go online and get fax numbers for prisons everywhere and fax bomb the fascists. The FBI has fax machines, too. They'd go bonkers if I shared that, so that's scrapped. Some would... Same with tying up phones and blitzing emails, or groups like Anonymous hacking their systems and making them crash. Advocating that might even be illegal. Fun with drones. I won't talk about that. Folks could wreak havoc from miles away. I'd never get out of the Super Duper Max. I have to think about my parole hearing in October, you know. I mean, I have to think about my October parole hearing if the September 9 strike doesn't choke the miserable life out of this foul and repulsive system. So I won't even talk about having dance parties on the sidewalk in front of prison officials' homes or canvassing their neighborhoods to inform the elderly neighbors that they have a state terrorist in their community. If I mention stuff like that, you might think it's funny, but FBI agents who put Sadiq in the hole wouldn't think it's funny at all. They have home addresses, too. At any rate, I guess I should just apologize and not record anything at all. I know a lot of you savage cannibals out there will be disappointed because you expect me to take the most radical, militant, sectarian position and scream it from the rooftops. But for once, I have to be careful. I have to think of myself. I can't even mention that prisoners might be organized on September 9th or that I support it. I'm sorry about that. I've got the FBI listening and I have to be careful, especially now that my segments can be uploaded from iTunes where I hang out with Madonna and Justin Bieber. You might think I'm a sellout, but the slightest hint, however amusing, that I'm endorsing a strike or organizing anything could get me in a whole mess of trouble. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
So we're speaking with Tyler Durden from Portland Anarchist Black Cross and the PDX chapter of the Industrial Workers of the World. Thanks a lot for having this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Would you tell folks a little bit about your chapter of ABC? What sort of work do y'all do and how long have you been around for?
So the Portland ABC has been around since 2012. We've done a lot of work on behalf of political prisoners. We did some work for folks like Jeff Lurz when he was getting out. And we've done a lot of work over the past few years, more specifically in working with general population prisoners. We've done a few campaigns against police violence, some mobilizations around that, and campaigns around defense against gentrification and displacement of homeless people in Portland. So we kind of have a broader purview than just prisoner support, because we view ourselves as a revolutionary anarchist organization, and we prioritize that work, but we allow ourselves room to do other things as well.
So you're also involved in the IWW, which is a 111-year-old radical industrial labor union, and the IWW seems to have been reinvigorated a lot in the last few years. Can you talk about IWOC, what it is, and what it's been up to?
Yeah, so IWOC is the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, and over the past few years, it's endeavored to assist prisoners with building a union for workers on the inside who are highly exploited by the prison system. So, yeah, over the past few years, they've slowly grown to having 800 to 1,000 active IWOC members on the inside throughout the country. You know, in May, there was a spontaneously organized work strike throughout the state of Texas by prisoners who came together and decided to take a stand against deplorable conditions throughout the state of Texas and self-mobilized, and then came to IWOC outside support chapters letting us know what they were doing. So there's a lot of active people on the inside pursuing their own, you know, interests and organizing. People like Rashid Johnson is a very active IWOC member on the inside who's in Texas, I believe, currently. You know, Sean Swain was formerly on the editorial board. I think he still is for the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee a newsletter that is sent out, just called The Incarcerated Worker, to prisons throughout the country, and it's a really, really good publication written by and for prisoners as well.
Can you talk a little bit about what that exploitation that you mentioned looks like? I mean, people may have the idea that going into prison means you get job training or that you, like, keep your head down, serve your time, and get back out.
Right. So in most of the prisons, they are in many prisons down south, I should say, there's prisoners aren't even paid a penny an hour. They're paid nothing, and they're forced to, thousands of people forced to go out and work, do hard manual labor, breaking rocks, you know, and even in many places down south, working like Angola State Prison is actually built on an old slave plantation where they, you know, forced former slaves to go out and pick cotton on the fields. So one of the big things with the September 9th mobilization going on right now is calling to attention to the 13th Amendment, wherein it's cited as, you know, the amendment that ended slavery. However, it says specifically that slavery will be abolished except for as used as a punishment for a crime. So the issue really comes in that, you know, slavery was never abolished in the United States and has in fact maintained throughout the history in different forms through convict leasing system, where prisoners were sold to corporations, would pay $1,500 per prisoners to the state of like Georgia, for instance, which actually comprised 70% of its budget in the early 1900s. The state's budget was actually from convict leasing and selling prisoners, and that practice continued from the quote-unquote end of official slavery to the 1940s, where, you know, then you have not too long after the real advent of mass incarceration in the United States and the situation that we have today. So yeah, that's the issue with prison labor. And you have corporations, everyone from Victoria's Secrets to Starbucks to JCPenney, McDonald's, they're all using prison labor. You got, you know, paying people pennies on the hour to work in sweatshops, making garments, people processing meat patties for fast food corporations. And then you have states using prison labor to run the prisons themselves. Prisoners, most of these prisons are actually ran by the prisoners. So prisoners are cleaning the facilities, doing the laundry, making the food, doing all of the basic infrastructural things to keep those places going, in addition to, you know, using prison labor to come out and, you know, pick up litter on the side of highways in like the Northwest and Northern California, for instance. 6,000 prisoners in just Northern California were forced, you know, are forced to go out every year and fight wildfires, and they force them to work for like 12 hours a day with no breaks to, you know, clear brush, working with like chainsaws and heavy, you know, dangerous machinery. And so in the state of Oregon, actually last year, we were informed about a situation where a prisoner was out there doing this type of labor, cutting down trees, and actually had a fallen tree crush his legs, you know, so he was crippled from that. And there's not, you know, any kind of workers' rights. They don't get the basic protections you would expect as a worker on the outside because of the fact that, hey, you can legally have them as a slave, you know, according to the U.S. Constitution. So it's very, very highly, highly exploitative situation going on with the prison labor. So
just to play devil's advocate for a second, with something like the working on the fire crews, it's a very dangerous circumstance. And hypothetically, if the state would provide like workers' comp or some sort of protections, like, wouldn't that be seen as an opportunity to take time off of one's existent, like the amount of time that the sentence that one's serving, or an opportunity to get out from the grounds, maybe learn some job skills or do something a little more exciting than being on the block?
Right. Well, that's the thing. That's so there's we have over 2 to 3 million people incarcerated in the United States. There's 600,000 that work full time. So even within the prison system, you still have this competition, right, for labor, for jobs, and it's different from state to state what the situation looks like. So, you know, in Oregon, in many facilities, prisoners they want jobs because they need them, right? Like we need to work on the outside. You know, we don't want to work, but you have to have, you got to pay for to get by. You got to pay for everything, you know, your house, you got to pay for your food, you got to pay for all these things. And it's the same way on the inside. People think, oh, it's a vacation, you're going in, you're getting everything paid for, but that's not the case. In fact, like, prisoners have to pay for all of their own toiletries, their toilet paper, their, you know, toothpaste, shampoo, and the food they serve in there is absolutely, absolutely terrible. You know, oftentimes it actually, we've got reports of them sending in food that's literally labeled unfit for human consumption, right? And so prisoners then also have to go to commissary to buy better food, you know, to supplement the terrible diets that they're getting. So really, they have to work to get the basic supplies that they need to survive in a very baseline kind of way. So when they don't work, they don't have an opportunity to get those basic necessities that, you know, and again, you can talk about telecommunications. So like a single phone call a prisoner might make for 10, 15 minutes costs them about $5. And when you're talking about somebody that's not working or somebody that's getting paid pennies on the hour, you can see that it's a lot of money to just maintain. And you got all of these companies that are selling these products on the inside, marking stuff up, charging way more for stuff than they would on the outside because you have a captured, you know, consumer market. And so these telecommunications companies are also making hundreds of millions of dollars a year just on like phone calls and stuff. So,
yeah. And that seems like a bad faith argument the state makes by quote-unquote providing services like that at such a high cost when so many people going into prisons are poor. And if the argument is that they're trying to decrease recidivism, why would they make this huge hurdle for people, keeping people in contact with their families and friends on the outside, giving them a reason to like work their way out of prison?
Right, absolutely. And nobody's leaving prison with a bunch of money saved up, you know? So you got people leaving prison with no you know, financial backing to get housing, to, you know, put themselves up till they find a job. And then you're also dealing with people that are marked for the rest of their lives with a felony on their record that comes up every single time, you know, they go in for to apply for a job, you know. So then they face all this discrimination from doing that. And then also to mention that, like, the type of jobs usually that they're providing for people on the inside are not the kind of jobs that we have on the outside, right? Like, you know, I think the number one job market on the outside right now is this food and service industry. And so you don't have a lot of the service industry on the inside, whatever it may be, you know, under that framework. So there's not a lot of big factory jobs out there. So yeah, it's kind of a really tough situation for people getting out and trying to get legs back on, you know, surviving on the outside.
All this talk about jobs and the kind of jobs that are being quote unquote offered to people on the inside who also, just to mention, have to pay exorbitant medical costs too for visitation. Right. Do the Wobblies as an organization take perspective on the jobs being provided to people on the inside versus those jobs being available to potential workers on the outside?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, right? Is like looking at, I think, like with the union piece and the jobs piece, you know, that's another argument in the fact that, well, it's like outsourcing, right? Like, you know, how many jobs since like deindustrialization in the 1980s with globalization have been shifted overseas to, you know, foreign countries. And people talk about that a lot, you know, because they're going to these cheap labor markets. Well, what they've done in the United States is the same thing by creating these, you know, pools of cheap labor with these, you know, prisoners, and then they can send in and set up shop there. And, but with the added benefit of literally many of these corporations, well, they're using prison labor, but then they can stick on the label made in the USA, you know? So there's a lot, there's like Prison Blues is a jean company and that uses prison labor here in Oregon at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution, right? And they're using prison labor that they have on there made in the USA. So that's definitely part of it, you know? They're saying, oh, what the while they're taking away jobs from the, you know, U.S. workers on the outside, they're simultaneously still trying to say, well, you know, made in America, a lot of these companies. So, yeah.
Or manufacturing military uniforms or
yeah, that's
government.
Unicor. So most of the federal prisons actually are employed by a corporation called Unicor that produces military flak jackets, helmets, even like components of some like Tomahawk missiles and stuff like that. So they also sell these products, you know, to other sources, but mainly they produce stuff for the United States military, and that's Unicor through the federal government and the federal prisons. So there's that connection to the from the prison industrial complex to the military industrial complex in a big way there.
And I remember going to college like in the early 2000s and living in the dormitories of a public college in California, and a bunch of the furniture that was in the dorms, for instance, was made by prisoners, got to be labeled made in the USA, and, you know, diverted, like, especially when politicians a few years earlier had been talking about outsourcing and got to put those labels on the materials they were buying for the, you know, for public use. Anyway.
Yeah, that's Aramark. Aramark makes, they use prison labor, and they provide a lot of the food for like universities and the school system. And they also make a lot of the furniture used in state buildings.
In the context of the September 9th National Prisoner Strike, can you talk about the significance of the date? Why was the 9th chosen?
So the 9th was chosen, September 9th was chosen because in 1971, there's the historic Attica Uprising, and it happened in upstate New York, where prisoners basically came together and in response to the state's murder of George Jackson a few weeks prior to this. And George Jackson was a very famous prison advocate and revolutionary, member of the Black Panther Party that was incarcerated for stealing a TV when his teens, and ended up having an open-ended sentence where he ended up remaining in prison for, you know, over a decade after when he was incarcerated. And so he wrote some books in the 1970s that were very popular with prisoners, and he was very well known, again, like a figure of resistance and a fighter for, you know, prisoners' rights and people of color's rights. And so when he was murdered by the state, prisoners at Attica had an uprising where they took control of the prison and had, you know, interracial alliance where they began just running the facility in a kind of egalitarian way and, you know, demanding for just basic, you know, like rights, just to be treated like human beings, you know, to not be brutalized on a daily basis, things like this, you know. And they had to take this bold action to alleviate this terrible conditions that they're in, just to get people to take notice. And the state responded by, you know, sending in the National Guard and murdering over 40 prisoners. So it's a symbolic day for prisoners across the country, a day of resistance.
We're speaking with Tyler Durden, a member of PDX ABC, or Portland Anarchist Black Cross, and Portland IWW, about the upcoming September 9th National Days of Prisoner Work Stoppage to End Prison Slavery in the United States. Can you talk about what the demands are that you've heard in terms of the strikes that are planned for the 9th, and who's been organizing the strikes?
So September 9th comes from various prisoner groups on the inside, mainly Free Alabama Movement, and there's been you know, some advocates such as Sadiq Hassan who have been very, very vocal and involved in the process of kicking off September 9th. And Sadiq Hassan is actually a prisoner who is on death row for his participation in the Lucasville Uprising in 1993. In Ohio, where prisoners were revolting in response to forced TB testing, primarily targeting people of color, and also they were they're protesting the expansion of the Supermax facility in the prison, and so the prison guards started roughing up everybody and doing a shakedown, and that kicked off the revolt there, which the state responded by murdering like 9 to 10 prisoners there. And so one prison guard was taken hostage and died in the process. And anyways, so there's 5 people that were put on death row as a result of that, Sadiq Hassan being one of them. And so that's kind of where the call is coming from. And basically the demand is for an end to prison slavery. And again, it's not just about the economics. It's not just about the working conditions. It's about the legacy of white supremacy and slavery in the prison system in the United States. It's, you know, it's all connected. The mass murder of people of color in this country every year by the police, you know. So it's really all connected. And with the prisoners, it's the way that it's gone about is prisoners can really decide in their local facilities what are the main issues that they want to organize around. So obviously the forced labor piece is a huge issue, but we also still have in many, many states across the country the practice of indefinite solitary confinement where, you know, prisoners can be stuck in an isolation cell for 23 hours a day for the rest of their lives with no human contact, only allowed out for 1 hour a day where they typically put them in a cage by themselves outside so they can get a little bit of fresh air or whatever. So that's, you know, a huge issue going on. You also have the, like many prisoners like in Holman, you know, some of the biggest issues was basic things like, hey, fix this like huge patch of like black mold growing that's like giving us all lung problems like in this prison because it's decrepit, you know, and like let out like your prison, like in the state of Alabama, I think the number of prisoners they had is twice the capacity that the prisons are like actually legislated or allowed to hold. So, but the thing is, like there, the fire marshal just takes a blind eye, you know, because it's the prison system. They don't care. So, like there, that's another big issue. Get the fire marshal out here. Close, you know, release some of these prisoners that should be released because they qualify for parole, but they don't want to let them go. You know, they don't want to release them for, you know, whatever reason it is, whether it's money or racism or, you know, all of it. So, so there it's, so, you know, those are some of the issues there, you know, and, so it's really, it's up to prisoners to decide what on the inside, what are the specific things they want to organize against. Right now we have 22 mothers in an immigrant detention center in Texas who have gone on who have called for an indefinite hunger strike until they achieve their, quote, immediate freedom. So you have people revolting to demand their immediate freedom. You have people revolting to end the labor situation. You have people revolting just to be treated like human beings and not be subjected to torture, you know, which is what indefinite solitary confinement is widely recognized as by many international bodies. So
in the last month, word's gotten out about repression against some of the individuals and groups that you're talking about here. Like, as I understand, the women who were the mothers that were on indefinite hunger strike, a number of them at least called off their hunger strike because the state was, in their circumstance, was threatening to take away their children if they were proved to be too weak.
Wow.
So, you know, extending repression, and right. Sadiq Abdul Hassan at OSP in Ohio, has been stuck in the hole ostensibly because of his like media work, reaching out to the outside right. to talk about organizing, for the Free Ohio movement and the Free Alabama yeah. movement. Although there was an uprising at the Holman facility you mentioned in Atmore, Alabama, uh-huh. A number of its organizers have been put in the hole. How can folks
Michael
on the out? Yeah, Michael Kimball, exactly. Also, Melvin Ray and Kinetic, I think, or Kinetic might be at St. Clair.
Right.
But how can folks on the outside offer support to those behind bars who are standing up and against prison slavery and getting repressed in these ways?
People on the outside should go to supportprisonresistance, .noblogs.org and check out the sidebar there. There's a regional list. You click on it and you go on. You can find different events happening in your area, hopefully in your city, and you can plug into those events going on. You can also go onto the contacts page there, and it'll have a list of state by state with different organizations that people can get involved with. And people should definitely try to plug into the ongoing work in their area because, you know, again, being a longtime prisoner support organizer, we know that there's oftentimes very few people doing this work in a sustaining way. And it's great that many people are getting involved now. But again, we hope that the prisons completely, you know, are destroyed on September 9th and go away. But in reality, it's probably going to be more of a long-term struggle, a long-term fight, and it's really important that people plug into some organizations or form some affinity groups that can stick around for a while because, again, a hunger strike or a work strike, they can last for months on end. So just in this campaign, we need people plugging in, you know, and so that's really important. And the other piece is, you know, go to you know, Google IWalk online, find the website. There's going to be some efforts right now to plug people into some nationwide coordinated cell phone blast networks so people across the country can call in and respond to some of the prisoner repression happening against people who are, you know, taking a stand. There's also the General Defense Committee, which is a committee within IWW, has a fundraising site up right now, and maybe we could link it into, like, the podcast or something, and basically they're trying to raise funds for prisoners who are going on work strikes, so again, they can get those basic necessities that they need to survive, so...
Are you up for answering a few more questions? That was a very complete and almost sounded like a wrap-up. But
sure.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. That's awesome that you gave all that information. I think the IWalk site is iwoc.noblogs.org.
Okay.
But yeah, I can totally plug in the GDC in there too and try to direct folks there. So recently the Obama administration declared that they'd be discontinuing private prisons. Can you talk about what that, because I've heard people have brought that up to me and I'm like, well, that probably means this very specific thing, but can you talk about that?
Yeah. So those, we've had this conversation in Portland in relation to our, you know, demonstration we're going to be holding on September 9th. And, you know, it's really important to, you know, understand that this is a political move, right? And this was on the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic establishment to try to pull in the more progressive or whatever voters who were going for Bernie Sanders, because that was one of Bernie Sanders' big campaign platforms, was he was going to divest from these private prisons, right? And so all of a sudden you have the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, the Obama administration saying, well, we're going to divest from private prisons when the federal government is, when in reality they've been getting, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations from the GEO Group and Corrections Corporations of America, which are the two biggest private prison corporations in the country that, you know, are lobbying politicians for harsher sentencing laws to fill their prisons, have even sued certain state governments because of them implementing leaner sentencing laws, because it would have resulted in a loss of profit for them because they would have less beds to fill and they get paid by the bed that they have from the state. So the thing is, there's no binding agreement on this declaration that they have created. They've said that they're going to divest by 2020. you know, but nothing's binding. You know, it has resulted in a bit of a loss of profits for these corporations and their stocks going down, which is nice. But the proof will really be in the pudding on that one, and see if they really follow through with actually divesting. And if we know anything about Obama's administration's record on shutting down prisons, I think the very first thing Obama said that he was going to do was close Guantanamo Bay. And 8 years later, it's still open. So I think that's just a political move they're saying to try to win over some voters on a non-binding thing that they can just blow away in the wind. The other point is that it's only 13 private prisons. Most private prisons are ran on a state level. So the corporations aren't going away that administer this stuff. Their lobbying efforts aren't going away. So they're not saying, you know, Obama administration has locked up more immigrants than any other presidency combined. So it's really just hollow political words spoken by another puppet that's not going to do anything. But I think it does demonstrate the power of grassroots organizing on these issues when these politicians feel the need to respond, you know. But it's important for people to understand that it's just more political maneuvering on their part. And so
that was a good slam on Obama, by the way.
Yeah.
Is there in any way, like, I'm not sure what the percentage of people that are being held in facilities in the U.S. are per who's running the facilities, but like federal prisons are different from state prisons, are different from county jails, are different possibly from immigration facilities too. So it's not like, and the exploitation is happening through privatized services inside of state run or federally run institutions anyway. So it's not right. Like it would get rid of profit motive or like,
oh yeah,
crappy services being provided or not provided,
no,
to people.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, even these state-run prisons have so many private corporations just making millions and millions and millions of dollars off of it that it's you're still going to have those companies lobbying for the same type of laws. You know, they're still going to be having that dynamic with how the prisons work, and it's not a question of like, well, it's not a question of like, oh, well, private prisons are bad, so let's just have regular prisons and problem solved. It's really, we have to get rid of all of the prisons. We have to, you know, get rid of the state, get rid of the cops, and because it's all interconnected. Capitalism, the state, the police, the formation of modern police, formation of the prison system, and contemporary, you know, white supremacist ideology. It all comes from the same, you know, nucleus of, you know, colonization and these efforts and these ways that they've devised our cities to be these weird, like, tourist Disneylands that have surveillance like their own prisons, you know. That's what I tell these guys, you know, here, it's like, it's basically a prison with more walking room, more vending machines, and more opportunities to get laid out. On the outside world when you're walking around. So it's all connected, you know, and it can't just be, we just got to get rid of the profit motive in prisons, because that's not really going to resolve the condition of slavery, ongoing slavery and oppression in this country ran by a terrorist state that keeps everybody in line with the constant threat of being locked up for your whole life or experiencing brutal violence at the hand of a thug with a badge and a gun, you know? So, you know, I mean, this is how the state's maintaining at this point in this country, is just through sheer state terror. I mean, that's why 50% of people don't even vote in elections, because they know it's all a joke, you know? So it's really central to get rid of these repressive apparatuses and, you know, show people there's a different way that we could be running our society and living our lives. So it's not just about getting rid of the a profit motive or this corporation or that corporation involved in prisons. It's about getting rid of the whole shebang. And those might be little steps to get there, but.
And I'd like to talk more about what that vision might be of alternatives. I just have a couple of specific questions that maybe you can answer, or maybe you might not know. But does production go on in immigration facilities in the same way that it does in non-immigration facilities? I know that folks that are being held under immigration laws sometimes get held in federal, state, and local facilities,
right?
At least while in transit. But does any sort of like profitable production or the running of the facilities get handled by inmates in immigration facilities? And is there any organizing going on around September 9th, do you know, for those facilities?
Yeah, so there's definitely prison labor being used at immigration facilities. We work with a group here in Portland that, you know, focuses specifically on, you know, divestment from private prisons, and works with many people in the immigrant community here. And they will tell you that there's definitely a lot of prison labor happening in these facilities, you know, doing the same thing, using prisoners to run some basic stuff. Because the thing is, the way that it works is you have they make money by running the cost of the facility under that $100 a day that they get paid per bed that they fill. So any way that they can use like unpaid, you know, labor from the people in there, that, you know, keeps their profits up. So that's happening all of the time. And again, you know, up in Tacoma a few years ago, that we have a big detention center here in the Northwest in Tacoma. And I think this was like maybe 2012 or 2013, there was a large, hunger strike up there due to the conditions. And it's terrible because these people get put in these detention centers, and a lot of times, well, most of the time, they don't have any idea even why they're there. So, like, maybe if you're lucky, they'll have some stuff translated into Spanish, but if you're from anywhere else, like, there's no literature telling you what's going on. There's no translators, so there's been cases of people in these facilities for years and years, and they don't know what the hell is going on. And that, to me, is just one of the most horrifying experiences I could imagine, you know. And then on top of that, much less can they request medical needs or express those needs when they're needed. So those go unchecked, and then the prisons neglect that kind of stuff all the time in these private facilities because it costs money to send a prisoner to get some medical attention. So you have people, you know, dying all the time in these places due to medical neglect. In 2008 in Texas, there was a prisoner who passed away, who wasn't getting the medications that he needed for a condition. And prisoners there revolted and, burnt down a huge part of the facility. They closed the facility. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but, you know, it's just an example of how, you know, how much of this is happening and what prisoners have to do just to get anybody to pay attention to what's going on, you know, inside of these places, you know. And so that's the importance of this work is, just in the really basic way of just keeping people looking at what's happening inside, you know, because that's the number one tool of control that they're implementing is that isolation, right? Building prisons far away from the cities where people have family so they can't see what's going on. And you got these wardens that rule these places like their little fiefdom. And, but when people start getting in the mix, you know, hey, what's going on? Sending in letters, you know, talking to prisoners, giving a little bit of, you know, an idea that people are keeping an eye. These guys change up their game a little bit more, so and to the prisoner's favor sometimes. So that's really important because, you know, again, when people are far away, nobody's watching. I mean, the state's not coming in and doing all these regulations, making sure they're running it all legal, you know, hardly ever. They have to have some kind of, like, something really bad happen, and the community calls for somebody to come in there to even take a look at it. So these places run with impunity many times. And, you know, if a prisoner does something they don't like over there, just throw them in the hole for the rest of their sentence, you know, maybe for the rest of their life. And if there's nobody on the outside to raise any alarm bells or to do anything about it, then that's just how it's going to be, you know. And so, yeah, just a major, it's just isolation and more isolation. And that's kind of how they control their divide and conquer schemes. But
so what sort of public events are planned in the Portland area that you can talk about in the run up to September 9th and on September 9th?
Well, we've been doing some educational events and panels and stuff with, you know, call-ins from people, you know, in Oregon, Joshua Kurt Redde, who's an anarchist prisoner that we support. We had him call in to a panel we did the other day. We've been doing art making art and materials and stuff for our Day of Action on September 9th, where we'll be meeting at Chapman Square at 2 p.m., and we'll be having a brief little teach-in and then marching down to some prison profiteers and wrapping back up at 6 p.m. and meeting again in front at Chapman Square, which is in front of the Justice Center, quote-unquote, and the detention center in downtown Portland, where we'll be doing a noise demonstration. September 7th, there's going to be a punk rock show, a benefit for the Portland ABC and the September 9th work happening at the NRS Info Shop. So those are the things coming up at this point in Portland. In the Northwest, there's also going to be a demonstration in Olympia, Washington, against one of the office buildings for the prison system here in Olympia. So if you can find out more information about all that stuff on supportprisonresistance.noblogs.org or on our website, pdxabc.org.
Cool. Thanks so much for the... I was just about to ask how people can keep up on Portland ABC. I guess a last question I got is... Well, no, not a last question. So what... For folks that are out there in the listening audience and hearing some of this stuff for the first time, possibly if it's coming over the radio where they live or gets shared with them, what might be some alternatives to police and prisons? Because, like, realistically, people do some antisocial things that hurt other people
right.
out there, and people want to feel
right.
relatively safe in their communities. But people probably also, if they have any sense of justice, want a solution that actually, like, you know, something that actually heals wounds or what have you. Like, there's the case of the judge in California who is stepping back from criminal prosecution cases because he gave a light sentence to a white college student, male college student, who was
right.
found raping a woman who was passed out and intoxicated behind a dumpster. And there's probably people
yeah.
that are, you know, the argument can sound kind of like a decarceration or towards an abolitionist ick perspective of like, well, this is going to have like a long-term effect on him. And, you know, we don't want to like ruin his life, but it doesn't take into account the effects and the impacts on the person who actually suffered at his hands. What's Portland ABC and IWOC proposing, or what are some of the folks that are doing some of this organizing proposing as alternatives, or your perspective, I guess?
Well, I'll speak from my perspective, and my perspective is that we really do live in a very, very alienated society that has been structured in a way to sell us this viewpoint on what human nature is as being this fundamentally greedy, competitive, you know, out to pull one over on each other mentality of people that, you know, don't have a lot of conviction or won't take a stand for something that's not in their own, you know, direct best interest, you know. And I think that mentality that's sold to us is what they try to beat into us with the prisons, with the isolation, with this recurring traumatization happening on a daily basis with this constant threat of violence and this reassurance that the state has a monopoly on violence and you really can't use it to defend yourself against that kind of violence, you know, that extends back to the genesis of this country with colonization and the genocide of our indigenous communities, the enslavement of black people, you know. So this is the context of the society that we live in that has never ceased its practice of genocide, of its practice of slavery. So it's hard to heal wounds that are still open and having salt poured on them day by day. So when you're in the middle of this conflict situation. You know, it's hard to speak of a way to even consider an alternative, right? Because we're constantly interfacing with this community that's being constantly traumatized, that's in this terrorist state, and people reproduce that in the way that they interact with one another. So it's hard to talk about how do you, within that context, construct a community that deals with itself like in a just, egalitarian way. But I think, like, first and foremost, we have to clear the slate of these institutions and these structures that continue to perpetuate this violence and this trauma. And then we also have to start dealing with that trauma and all of these things in a way that we come to an honest look at how it's impacted our daily lives and informed a lot of our viewpoints on how we view the world. And, you know, and then at the end of the day, we got to come together as a community that's not, you know, just existing on Facebook, you know, because that's, you know, with the way our cities are built today, we're separated, you know, everyone's separated out and living in different places, and people network with their friend groups based on common interests that they already have, you know, and it's not really based in a geography or a land base that we have a sense of ownership over. And that's always the central root of any colonization process, is separating people from a land base. You know, counterinsurgency efforts from Iraq to Israel to, you know, Algeria, to all of this colonization is all about that, and breaking down, like, any potential radical or revolutionary connection with the people and the community. And so it's really got to come back to being about taking ownership, land-based struggle over our land and our communities and the people around us that don't think exactly like us, and coming and getting to know people, you know, getting to really know the people that live around us. And I think once we break down society, break down this mass bureaucratic, you know, nation state that's way too large and overbloated and alienated to a level of, you know, functioning on our communities in a space that we can have some human agency over, like, then we can know the people that are around us. We can know what they are about. We can know the interpersonal conflicts going on. And as a community, we can figure out how to deal with people on a subjective level, as opposed to doling out, cookie cutter, you know, sentencing for whatever crime it is, when everybody's coming from a different, you know, space in life, or why they've done the things they have done, or whatever it may be, you know. So being able to have a community where you can figure that out, you know, your problems within the community. You know, if someone's causing problems, someone's being an asshole, you come to a decision on how to deal with it, you know, and hopefully you can come to a positive resolution. But again, if you have somebody that's like a rapist or a murderer, or you're going around, you know, like some kind of psychopath, like they try to tell us, oh, that you got all these serial killers everywhere, that's why we need the prisons and this and that, look at this, the terrorism happening, oh, fear is why we need this stuff. And it's like, that is such a small percentage of the people that are in our prisons. The vast majority are, you know, nonviolent offenders. So once we get rid of all the nonviolent offenders, and we talk about, okay, the real dangerous people that they're using the whole rationale for maintaining the police and the prisons on, it's a very small percentage that we could figure out as a community how we want to deal with them. So that's for me the solution right there. But
for folks that are maybe coming across some of these ideas for the first time, are there a couple of resources or book titles that you might point them towards around restorative justice or about prison or police abolition?
I think, a great entry point is really Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. I mean, a lot of people are familiar with that. I would check out any of Sean Swain's writings about stuff if you want to get a prisoner perspective on some things. Like, I would check out his writings and, you know, his podcast and stuff. And, there's just a lot of different materials out there, but I don't know, maybe those are two good entry points.
Sean Swain advocates eating children, does he not?
he's my presidential candidate, so whatever he says, I'm behind.
Awesome. Cool. Well, we've been speaking with Tyler Durden from the PDX Anarchist Black Cross and IWW. And I thank you so much, Tyler, for taking the time and answering so eloquently the questions I posed.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
More information about the work that Portland Anarchist Black Cross does can be found at pdxabc.org. And more info on the upcoming prisoner strike and how to get involved can be found at supportprisonerresistance.noblogs.org. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bruce O'Goodness.